Hello and welcome once again to the Sophianic School of Arts and Sciences. I'm recording on the 13th of February 2019 with an open presentation. That is to say, this talk or reading is available to all visitors and guests to the campus of NEMATA. I present this reading with a special purpose in mind, relating to a rare and precious treasure in my life. I'm going to read a passage from metahistory.org about a physical treasure that I found. Being a Turton, that's what I do. I find things, I find treasures, mine treasures. And that particular treasure, the subject of this talk, is a manuscript of the 12th century. But the other treasure that I have in mind right now is my lifelong friend, Jan Michel Kerouac. Jan's birthday is coming up in a couple of days, on the 16th, and so I'm dedicating this reading to her memory. I met Jan on Wednesday, the 18th of January, 1967, if you can believe that. And in fact, Jan was born on the 16th, so that was, and she was born in the year 1952. So I met her a couple of weeks before her 15th birthday. I'll get back to Jan at the close of the reading. By the way, I'm recording this talk on a different system in my office. I'm not in the usual studio corner. I think the sound quality is acceptable. I am standing, and you may hear me moving around a little bit. Now, as many of you know, who are guests and visitors at NEMATA, and certainly as all the staff know, the student teachers who contribute financially to the school, some of the material you find here has been taken from metahistory.org. That was a huge site that went online, let's see, in July of 2002, and I ran it steadily until 2018. So I ran it for 16 years, and it was an open source, what can you call it? It was a vast library of material, talks and texts, hundreds and hundreds of illustrations. It was a compilation and showcase, I guess you could say, for my work in its many facets. So that was free. And now I'm importing that material to NEMATA. But I am also, as you know, adding original and new content to NEMATA. Also, as explained in the introduction to the school somewhere on this platform, the advance of NEMATA and the genius of the school is to organize the massive content of MidiHistory.org, plus my other writings, published and unpublished, into a more accessible and user-friendly system. I used to get frequently lost on MetaHistory. I sometimes still get lost on NEMATA, but it's coming along. March 18th, a little over a month from now, will be 6 months. And my goal by the six-month anniversary is to have all of the blocks in the courses organized, or all of the content of units in the curricula of the courses organized, and if possible, to have Block 101 established for all courses 1 through 12. Right now, I can't even tell you how many Block 101s I have so far finalized. I don't really know. It's difficult to keep track. I have a page here at hand. Actually, there are 5 copies of this page. 2 of them are on the wall, one over there at that part of the studio, one here, and the others lay around on the table so I can look at them constantly. these pages show a simple listing of the 16 units in the platform of Nemata, from one, Gayan Alchemy, down through the 12th course, Contraviolence, going through the three vocations, Humanity, Celestics, and the GNE, coming to the Grand Hall, 16 Planetary Tantra, and including 17, the Terma and the Turton, and 18, Breaking News. And I have to keep this in front of me constantly. For instance, right now, I'm going to read you a text extracted from metahistory.org. And as I look at this, I have to ask myself the question, where is it going to go in Nemata, you see? But in order to answer that question, I have to look at this piece of paper to remember all of the facets of Nemata and how those facets provide for the organization and clarification of this lavish and dense material. So that's how it works at my end. So the piece I'm going to read you now will properly appear in Nemata under the category or in the classroom of 9, biomysticism. In fact, biomysticism, and there is already a block 101 of biomysticism, I believe, biomysticism will have a subsection on psychonautics. So this piece is drawn from the psychonautic section of Metahistory, and it reappears along with other material previously posted and new material and edited material eventually in Course 9, Biomysticism. So, patience be with you, my friends. It's an enormous undertaking to organize the material from metahistory.org and other material into the classrooms of Nemata. And bear in mind also that I only have one individual doing this with me. One individual who is the admin, the overseer, editor, in charge of mailing list, in charge of answering email, and a half a dozen other things that I can't even think of at this moment. So we're pedaling as fast as we can. And I wish that you find what you're looking for here. I really do. And I wish that you enjoy the process of discovery and the adventure that Nemata offers, particularly the adventure of Planetary Tantra. So, the text I have before me is called The Discovery of a Lifetime. Now, some of you may know that if you go to metahistory.org today, most of the material has been removed, but I have left some material on. Now, there's a task at hand. It's not a high priority, and I don't know when we'll get around to it. But I do want to put some pieces back on Metahistory, and some in the manner of securing the interest there, and in the manner of presenting previews of material that will lead people to the school. You know, Metahistory, having a history of 17 years on the internet, is well embedded in the search engine zone, and consequently, all your search engines on the internet will bring up thousands of references to material on Metahistory, which is no longer there. Nemata.org doesn't have anything like that kind of traffic yet, so you can see the challenge that's involved here. But for right now, I'm giving you a preview of this piece, which is open, free for public consumption on Metahistory. And it's a preview of material on psychonautics that will appear eventually in Course 9. It's called The Discovery of a Lifetime. And the first thing that you see on that page, you may read the text while I'm reading it to you if you like, you see the top half of one of the 12 panels of a Psalter. That's a prayer book. And it illustrates biblical scenes with the detail, vivid detail, unmistakable, of psychoactive mushrooms. So let me tell you the story of these remarkable images.
In November 2006, shortly after the publication of my book, Not in His Image, where I describe entheogenic rites in the pagan mysteries at Eleusis and elsewhere, I made a long-awaited visit to the National Library in Paris. Upon acquiring a membership card, I was able to consult the archives for Greek and Latin manuscripts, of which the BNF, Bibliothèque Nationale de France, has an impressive collection. I was in quest of a very particular item, Latin MS 8846, called the Paris Edwine Psalter. And this is the single and unique illuminated manuscript of the 12th century, the only one of its kind in the world. Now, I was not able to handle the actual MS, obviously, but I examined the color microfilm made from it. My session of about 3 hours in the microfilm booth left me with wide eyes, a slack jaw, and unsteady feet. I literally staggered out into the Rue de Richelieu, and for the rest of the evening, I remained in a state of astonishment, totally stunned by the images I'd seen rolling across the microfilm screen. Psychedelic Bible. The Paris Edwine Psalter is an oversized bound book of about 184 sheets, about 367 pages counting both sides. The cover page is stamped volume number 174, 10 October 1873, presumably the day when it was acquired and cataloged. It opens with five full-page panels divided into 12 sections, lavishly colored and detailed. The panels show incidents from the Old Testament, running from the creation of Adam and Eve to the life of the patriarch Jacob. There immediately follow many half-page and full-page illustrations of the Psalms, interspersed with Latin commentary. After about 100 pages come four more 12-section panels, resuming the story of Jacob. Then the illustrations jump to the Ark of the Covenant, David and Goliath, and John the Baptist. About 45 pages further on, there is a unique page composed of 18 panels celebrating Jesus Christ, followed by two more 12-page panels illustrating events in the life of the Savior. Now, all this is totally biblical narrative, needless to say, and the text is larded with pious commentary and directions for song and prayer. The Edwine MS is, after all, a psalter intended for use by a choir or congregation in reciting prayers. What is far from routine, however, is the way the book is illustrated. Blue staining mushrooms and mushroom-like omphale occur in lavish form in the first 100 pages. Dozens of pages display versions of a stylized tree with a blue trunk, depicting how psychoactive mushrooms grow from the trunk of a single fruiting body that sprouts from the mycelium. And you see the illustration below there. The color of the blue is vivid and accurate to nature. Often the mushroom trees are integrated into dramatic scenes showing humans interacting with angels and demons. Some elaborate scenes depict apocalyptic events with the figure of Christ often placed next to a huge mushroom cluster. The intertwining stems of the fungi, realistically shown as slender and curvaceous, just as they appear in the wild, are artistically woven in the Celtic style of the Book of Kells and other Irish illuminated manuscripts from the same era. In many scenes, illustrations below, a naturalistic mushroom nestles among ornate omphalos buds that recall the segmentation of raspberries and blackberries. Yet these latter forms are clearly not naturalistic. They are carefully painted ovals or egg shapes, distinct from the slender pin-headed mushrooms without segmented heads. Clearly, the artists knew the difference between stylistic and naturalistic representation and quite intentionally chose to juxtapose the two. I suggest that the omphalos bud was an artistic convention of the mysteries intended to indicate how molecular structure looks in the visionary trance induced by psychoactive plants. Now, if you're following the text as I read, you see there another elaborate illustration from the Psalter. Now, there is considerable confusion about the naming of Latin MS-8846, called the Anglo-Catalan Psalter, because it was made in Canterbury, England, around 1180 CE. It is sometimes called the Canterbury Psalter. It was left unfinished, take note, and taken to Spain for completion, hence the odd name Anglo-Catalan. At the time of its construction, another nearly identical psalter was produced in Canterbury, MSR 17.1(987), kept at Trinity College, Cambridge, England. Both psalters are attributed to the master scribe named Eadwin. I believe it's pronounced Eadwin. Generous friend, which means a generous friend. And both contain the same sequence of narrative events. But the Canterbury Psalter, MSR 17.1, displays none of the entheogenic imagery of BNF Latin MS-8846, the Paris Eadwine Psalter. Now, in 1935, M.R. James published a reduced facsimile of the Cambridge MS. And more recently, in 1992, it has been published as the Eadwine Psalter by the Modern Humanities Research Association of Pennsylvania State University in the United States. This book can be ordered on Amazon.com for a hefty price. I have it right here on hand. Disappointingly, it shows that the Cambridge MS is totally devoid of the psychoactive mushroom imagery you find in the Eadwine Psalter. Now, in a chapter of the 1992 facsimile book, religious scholar Patricia Sterneman discusses the relationship of Latin MS-8846 to its Canterbury counterpart. Do you follow that? Amazingly, she does not allude in any way to the lavish mycological imagery of the Paris MS, nor does she explain how two manuscripts produced from the same source at the same time could be so utterly different in visual presentation. So, what do you conclude? Well, I'm pretty sure you conclude what I conclude. To scholars, the presence of psychoactive mushrooms in religious art is a closed subject, a revelation too outrageous to admit. But for this self-taught scholar, namely yours truly, it was the discovery of a lifetime. Intentional blindness. In 2002, Spanish publishing company Moliero published an exact copy of the Paris Eadwine Psalter, including the natural blemishes of the original pages. The only earlier facsimile edition was published in Copenhagen in 1958. The meticulous catalog description of this book, again, makes not the slightest allusion to mushroom imagery or anything at all unusual in the illustrations of the MS. The sample pictures offered by Moliero, are carefully cropped to avoid any evidence of offensive fungi. Or fungi, I guess some people say. The allusion is to fun, and they leave out the fun, don't they? Now, another online resource, Facsimiles of Manuscripts Illuminated in the British Isles, see if that link still works, reproduces some telltale scenes, but without comment on what's being shown. Now, an article on the Moliero edition in the UK online magazine Church Times, July 2005, says, The Psalter, also known as the Anglo-Catalan Psalter, was made in Canterbury about 1180, 12th century, end of the 12th century. It was left unfinished, and after 1200 was taken to Catalonia, perhaps as a gift. In the middle of the 14th century, the decoration of the manuscript was completed by Catalan artists, probably working in Barcelona. The book was meant to be a copy of a famous Carolingian 9th century Psalter, the Utrecht Psalter, and was acquired by the Christ Church Cathedral Priory in Canterbury in about the year 1000. The original was named after the city to whose university library it now belongs and was made at the Benedictine Abbey in Hautevilliers, near Reims, between 820 and 835, referring here to the Utrecht Psalter, a cousin to the Paris-Edouin Psalter, elder cousin, you could say. Each psalm is illustrated by drawings with an attempt to depict certain passages in the text and by amalgamating a number of scenes into a single rectangular picture. End quote. The article loosely associates the BNF Latin MS 8846, the Anglo-Catalan Psalter loaded with mycological imagery, with the mushroomless Canterbury Psalter. Both originated in the area of Cambridge around 1120, 1180, but only the latter remains in that town to whose university library it now belongs. It explains correctly, the article, that the Psalter kept in Cambridge, the one without mushrooms, was made first. And then came the great Canterbury Psalter, or the Anglo-Catalan Psalter, which followed all the innovations of the Edouin Psalter. So you see how they kind of mix up and confuse these two. I get the sense that they don't exactly get the picture of the sequence of the creation and the parallelisms between these different psalters. It, presumably the Anglo-Catalan Psalter, has three parallel texts, Latin, Hebrew, and Catalan, and also has the prefatory illustrations of the Old and New Testaments. To an extent, it is a copy of the Edouin Psalter, particularly in its text, but the artists of the illustrations seem, on occasion, to have referred back to the original Utrecht Psalter of the 9th century. End quote. This commentary is both confused and confusing. The Anglo-Catalan Psalter is MS 8846 in Paris. This is certain because it is the one that was begun in England and completed in Spain, in Catalonia. It is a copy of the British Edouin Psalter, yes, if that came first, but quite different in respect to its illustrations. Up to about page 100, the Paris-Edouin Psalter is loaded with mycological imagery, but after that, there is none. This suggests that the mushroom illustrations were done in England when work on the MS started, but not continued until it was finished in Spain. The expert commentary notes that the Canterbury illustrations, common to both MS, presumably, were based on the Utrecht Psalter, which also displays, by the way, the vivid image of a mushroom tree in the Garden of Eden. But the commentary makes no mention of that detail. Failure of attention or intentional blindness? Disregarding the blatant differences in illustration of the two Canterbury Psalters, scholars tend to confuse the two manuscripts. As I noted elsewhere, the Wassons knew of the mushroom imagery of the Utrecht Psalter, which was found or created in Reims, in France, around 800 CE, a couple of centuries or more before the Edouin Psalter. And that knowledge might have but seemingly did not lead them to discover the Paris Psalter. Now, the article continues. A decision was made to alter radically the appearance of the illustrations by changing the monochrome or colored drawings of the Utrecht and Eerdwijn Psalters to colored images with larger figures and burnished gold grounds. The technique used for the most luxuriously illustrated books of the late 12th century. This new style of illustration required the artists to make many innovations in the visual composition of their imagery. Of all the copies of the Utrecht Psalter, this one made the greatest demand on the creative ingenuity of its artists, end quote. Again, in spite of such elaborate description of artistic techniques involving close comparison of three distinct works of art, no expert has a single word to say about the mushrooms depicted vividly in the Paris MS and, more occasionally, in the Utrecht Psalter. It appears that religious scholars practice intentional blindness when it comes to this extraordinary aspect of this work of sacred art. Private illuminations. I am no expert on medieval illumined manuscripts, obviously. But from what I can gather, the Paris Eerdwijn Psalter was the unique production of British Celtic artists who supplied the mycological material when the MS was begun. For some reason, their work was interrupted. In Catalonia, the artists who took over the job phased out the mushrooms, which do not appear at all after page 100, as I noted. Odd, since mushrooms of the genus Psilocybe are known to grow prolifically in Catalonia on the south-facing slopes of the Pyrenees. Of course, they also grow prolifically all over England, Wales, and Ireland. We may infer a division of opinion among the two teams of scribes who produced the Latin MS 8846. The second shift of artists in Catalonia did not eliminate the mushroom imagery of the first team, but they did not continue it either. Whatever the case, quote, the technique used for the most luxuriously illustrated books in the late 12th century, end quote, was applied to this masterpiece, suggesting that someone was putting a lot of time and money into it, intending to produce a prized work of religious art. Now, I wonder if the individual or group who initially conceived this extraordinary book had in mind to illustrate it fully and completely with mushroom imagery. Did the, quote, generous friend, unquote, who sponsored the Paris Eerdwijn Psalter and may have had a hand in directing its initial execution, want to share entheobotanical illuminations with the world at large? Was the construction of the MS interrupted because someone else was against this disclosure? So there again, if you look at the page on medhistory.org, you see the concluding illustration I've posted, which is totally, totally staggering. This is a detail from Folio 5V, and the illustration is attached, believe it or not, to Psalm 1. So I conclude, on Jan's birthday, the year 2008, this seems probable. Something like that may have occurred, a censoring, in other words. But given how little we know about its origins and production, it is impossible to be certain about how and why the Paris Eerdwijn Psalter was created. So that concludes the reading of the text. Now I'd like to add a couple of personal comments, not merely for the purpose of personal disclosure. No. Comments I'm going to make now are extremely pertinent to the history of my generation. And I ask you to think closely about what I'm going to say and to retain some of the points that I make here. By my generation, I mean the generation of the 1960s, the psychedelic generation. Now, you recall that I mentioned the Wassons in this article. Who are the Wassons?
Well, the Wassons are a couple, Gordon Wasson, R. Gordon Wasson, and his Russian wife, Valentina. And they are famous figures of my generation of the 60s. Wasson was the man who went to Mexico and met the Mazatec shaman, Maria Sabina, in the mid-50s, and who experimented with psychoactive mushrooms in a shamanic session with her in several. And it is noted that that event was the key event, or one of the key events, of introducing my generation to the use of psychedelics, not only synthetic psychedelics such as LSD and mescaline, but natural psychedelics such as psilocybe mushrooms. Now, those visits of Wasson to Mexico in Mexico took place when I was only 10 years old, 10, 11, 12. And then when I hit my teens in the 60s, my whole generation was fascinated by the prospects and possibilities and promises of the psychedelic experience. Now, you know, that word psychedelic has become discredited, unfortunately so. And generally today, it has been replaced by the word entheogenic. So the Wassons got clued to mushroom cults in ancient times by the poet Robert Graves in an exchange of letters. And Robert Graves spoke about the use of mushrooms by witches in Portugal, which is the direction that I'm looking right now, toward Portugal. And this little clue got the Wassons going on a certain trail of investigation. Robert Graves, by the way, was the British poet, biographer, and mythographer who wrote The White Goddess. And he himself took mushrooms and used psychedelic mushrooms and participated in group events where people ingested these mushrooms on the island of Mallorca. And in fact, I have a very, very old friend named Richard Lair who used to live there on Mallorca and knew Graves and joined him at some of these events, which people would call parties, because they were instances, I would call them parties, because they were instances of using mushrooms, consuming psychoactive plants, which are sacred in a mundane or non-sacred setting, that is to say, recreationally, which I never do. I only consume them ritualistically. So, it appears that I can add my name to the record, and I do want to add my name to the record. The Wassons, following up on a clue from Robert Graves, were eventually led to the Utrecht manuscript, which shows Adam and Eve standing in front of the Tree of Life, but the Tree of Life is a mushroom tree. However, they did not continue their investigation down that particular track, which led me to the Bibliothèque Nationale de France on that particular day in the year 2006. So I can happily say and proudly say, and let it be recorded in the annals of Planetary Tantra, that I took that investigation a step beyond where the Wassons took it. Now, there's a lot of discussion about the Wassons over the last few years and about the way that Wasson, who was a New York banker for Morgan Stanley, I believe, was the key figure in triggering the psychedelic revelation and revolution. It was both a revelation and a revolution. And that has led some people, such as Jan Irvin, I-R-V-I-N, who interviewed me like many, many years ago, probably around 2006, just before my book came out. That has led Jan Irvin and others to make the claim that the entire movement of my generation was conceived, plotted, and orchestrated from day one by the CIA. And there's a lot of evidence
to prove that. There's a lot of evidence to support his case. But also, I find that a lot of the evidence and reasoning of Jan Irving in that argument is specious. He tends to make people guilty by association, and correlation is not causation. So he tends to overdevelop the case, but he has a good point in certain respects. In fact, there's even a snippet on the internet which shows Timothy Leary saying that he owes everything that he accomplished to the CIA. So there you have it. Well, I have been deeply involved in that whole story. On the one hand, on one side of my life, there was Jan Michel Kerouac. On the other side of my life, there was another individual who happened to have been a key figure in the life of Timothy Leary. In fact, was married to Timothy Leary. So I'm in a unique position to know the story of Leary's involvement with the CIA. And I'm going to have some more to say about that soon. But right now, I just want to point out that even if it was true, as Jan Irving claims, that the CIA conceived and orchestrated the psychedelic generation of the 60s, I must insist, as a member of that generation, that the movement and the impulse behind it was larger than life and was not something that the CIA could manage or control ultimately. And I stand as proof of that claim. I can assure you that neither Jan Kerouac or myself was involved in any way with the CIA. And neither were millions and millions of other hippies, although we were not hippies, not by a long shot, and millions of other participants in that unique and groundbreaking generation. So perhaps Jan Irving would want to consider me a suspicious character, you know, a person of interest, one of the usual suspects of that generation. It's a fact that the key conversation of Gordon Wasson and a reporter that led to Wasson's shamanic experiences in Mexico being featured in Life magazine, or was it Look magazine? No, it was Life magazine. And going to the mainstream, it is true that the conversation that led to that took place in the Century Club in New York City. And I've been to the Century Club, so I suppose I would be guilty by association, according to the reasoning of Jan Irving and others. But I have more to say about his program to completely trash the reputation and destroy the authenticity of my generation. And I stand strongly against his argument, and I stand as proof that his argument is not completely correct. Now, just in concluding, I'll come around to Jan again. I hadn't known when I started to present this article as a preview for you that I wrote it on her birthday, or uploaded it on her birthday, 2008. That was 11 years ago. As I said, Jan was just a few days shy of her 15th birthday when I met her. And during those early days and weeks of our relationship, we had long, long conversations. And she spilled a great deal to me about her earlier life. Now, Jan had begun taking LSD when she was 12. So she'd already been taking it for more than a couple of years, and she had taken some very, very extensive trips. In fact, the experience got out of hand for her, and she was extremely leery, if you'll pardon the reference, to taking LSD again. So Jan and I did not, except on one occasion, take LSD together. And we, in fact, moved away from that whole scene. We didn't like the hippies at all. And we went and led our own lives. But I just want to close by telling you two wonderful details about my early conversations with Jan Michel Kerouac.
Now, she described to me the psychedelic experiences that she'd had with LSD, usually in the company of her boyfriend at the time, and his name was Paul. Paul with a second name initial O. She talked a lot about Paul O, the things they did together, the trips they took. And among the many things she told me, I'm describing here my conversations with a girl of 14 years, not yet 15 years old, stunningly beautiful, brilliant, brilliant, IQ of 187. She said to me that once she was on a trip and she happened to be in a room with two college students, two young guys, a bit older than her, probably in their late teens. And they were also tripping, apparently. And they were having a conversation in which Jan participated. And they were studying in college biochemistry. And in the course of this conversation, it came to light that Jan said that they described molecular structure. They were talking about the discovery of the structure of DNA in 1952, the year Jan was born, close to that anyway, 54 maybe. They were talking technically as two college students about the structure and properties of DNA, and Jan was listening with her sparkling intelligence, and she said that what they were describing, she had seen. So Jan Kerouac, at the age of 14, told me that she had seen the molecular structure of matter on LSD. Now, years later, I came to see the same thing. I came to see, to have the same experience, but not on LSD, but through the ritual use of psychoactive mushrooms. So you could say that Jan, at 14, cued me to that experience. And as you know, as those of you who have followed me know, the elaborations of what I have discovered and taught regarding the molecular structure of nature and the shaman's ability to perceive the depths of nature forms a great part of Planetary Tantra. Secondly, Jan described another experience to me. We used to talk a lot about Egyptian mythology, and I used to see her at times as an Egyptian princess. Her hair and her face resembled uncannily some cameos of Egyptian princesses that you find in the art of Egypt of the Pharaonic dynasties. And she described to me how she took LSD late one night in New York City alone, and she found herself out in the streets in the dead of night, 3 or 4 in the morning in the Lower East Side. And she said that she felt that she was accompanied by a presence, the presence of Anubis. So Jan at 14 could talk to me in depth about Egyptian mythology in addition to molecular biology. And Jan told me that she knew that Anubis, or Anubis, was the guardian of the necropolis. She used the word necropolis. She knew what a necropolis was. She told me, hey, I saw that New York City was just a necropolis. Can you imagine that? She saw the thriving city of New York with its 8 million inhabitants as a dead zone, a necropolis. And she told me that the outstanding experience that she had as she walked through the corridors of the apartment building we were in, the old slum tenement building, and down the corridors and down the stairs and along another corridor, and even as she walked out into the streets, she's walking in the middle of the street, and on either side of her, the dingy gray buildings are rising up to 6, 7, 8 stories. That's the Lower East Side.
and all of the walls parallel to her on either side were alive with hieroglyphics. And she explained also a remarkable phenomena which I carried with me and I later developed extensively in my book Twins and the Double and in other talks and writings. She described the phenomena of chirality, C-H-I-R-A-L-I-T-Y, that is the right and left-handedness of the structure of the natural world as we perceive it. Handedness. And she explained how when she was walking in a trance state down the middle of the deserted streets of the Lower East Side in the depths of night with Anubis watching over her, that if she turned to right or left, the whole city turned with her, because the chirality of her vision moved as she moved. I have also been able to confirm this phenomenon of shamanic experience in my later work. So there you have it. I just wanted to give you a glimpse of what kind of a creature she was, what kind of a magical girl was Jan Kerouac, a creature of delight, a creature of brilliance and mischief. And so I dedicate this reading to her for the commemoration of her birthday, February 16th.